It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Last fall, 90.5 WESA reported on a collaborative study between the University of Pittsburgh and Pittsburgh Public Schools on the link between racial identity and student achievement. They hypothesized that negative racial identities among young children was contributing to the performance gap among minorities and sought to find out why. After months of research, representatives are here to tell us about the study from Pitt's School of Education, Pathways to Kindergarten Success and Center for Urban Education, as part of WESA's Life of Learning initiative. I'm joined now in studio by Aisha White, Director of Pathways to Kindergarten Success. Aisha White, welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us, Shannon Wanless, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology in Education at the University of Pittsburgh. Shannon, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having us.
And Erica Gold Kestenberg, Associate Director for Community Partnerships and Practice for the Center for Urban Education, Associate Director for Community Partnerships and Practice for the Center for Urban Education at Pitt. Welcome, Erica.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
And you can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is essph@wesa.fm and on Twitter at essph. Again, the number 412-246-2002 to join our conversation. And Shannon Wanless, I'll begin with you and just sort of a basic overview of the issue of identity. Explain to us what exactly a positive racial identity is and how African-American children are not necessarily getting one.
Well, a positive racial identity is being aware of your race, the history of your race and characteristics of it, and building a positive sense of what that means. So feeling good about who you are and the race that you're a part of.
And the study points out that being colorblind does not exactly work. Why is that?
Well, I think there is a huge misconception that if we don't talk about race, maybe racial discrimination will develop. But actually, that's not the case. When we don't talk about race with children, we allow other influences, such as media and so forth, to give them their ideas about race rather than the important adults in their lives.
And Aisha White, you said that that earlier study that most Black children have white teachers, but their training may be lacking when it comes to preparing them to teach African-American students.
Yes, and that's a question that I think could be better answered by Shannon or Erica. I can address some of the information that our listeners might want to gain about the original studies of children's racial identity development as it relates to the Dahl study, but I'll pass that over to Erica or Shannon.
All right. Well, let's get Erica involved in the conversation. And what are your thoughts about let's talk about the Dahl study. And let's go back to Aisha, and then we'll get to Erica on this. The 1947 Dahl study, explain what that was for people that don't remember it.
Mm-hmm.
Very famous study.
Yeah, so actually it was a series of studies that occurred between 1939 and 1940. It was conducted by a husband and wife team, Kenneth and Mamie Clark. And what they did was they took groups of young African-American children between the ages of 5 and 7. They put in front of those children two different dolls. One was a white doll, one was a black doll. The only difference was skin color, hair color. And they asked the children questions such as, which is the good doll? Which is the bad doll? Which doll would you prefer to play with? Which is the nice doll? And overwhelmingly, the African-American children chose the white doll. And then later, much later, decades later, in 2005, there was a young woman who did a documentary film called A Girl Like Me, where she looked at issues around racial identity, beauty in terms of African-American girls. But she also recreated the Dahl study and included that in the documentary. There were 21 kids who were of the same ages in that recreation. And of them, there were 15 kids who chose the white doll over the black doll. So what they saw was that kids did not have a positive self-esteem around their race. They didn't have a positive identity around their race, and it was a cause for concern. And the findings from the original study were actually used in testimony in the Brown v. Board of Education desegregation case, and it kind of convinced some of the judges in that case that segregation did need to end because it was negatively impacting Black children.
So over the course of 60 years, not 70. Much, 70 years, yeah, that was one of the courses that I didn't do as well in was math.
Okay.
So 70 years, but not much has changed
in
all those decades.
Right.
I mean, how discouraging is that for those of you who are studying this, we've known that there's a problem and we don't seem to be addressing it or addressing it effectively?
Mm-hmm. Did you want to address that, Shannon?
Well, although it could be discouraging, it's also an opportunity. And this is really where we begin our work and come together and say, rather than thinking about when children are older and we see more obvious signs of the harm of discrimination, how can we think about them when they're young and get on the ground early and start to influence their ideas about positive racial identity and fairness before they start to firm up later on?
So let's bring Erica back into the discussion now. So Aisha White was talking about that earlier study that involving the dolls and the fact that not much has changed over that period of time. Shannon says that that's an opportunity. Talk about the opportunity there that now exists.
So the opportunity now is really to start talking about race in ways that we haven't had the courage to do so in our country thus far, and especially in Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh, unfortunately, is one of the most racially, residentially segregated cities in the country. We have a lot of disparities around every aspect of life for African Americans in our city, and there's a lot of work to be done. And so the opportunity here is the more that we talk about it, the more we can do something about it. I think awareness is the first step. And having these conversations, and I really appreciate you bringing this to the forefront for us and with us, is the first step. And so we really need to educate our whole city about what is going on in terms of the quality of life for African Americans. And education, of course, being from the School of Education, we think is one of the keys to this. And having explicit conversations around race for educators, for community members, for family members, and this is for people of all races, really, to be having these conversations. Where it lies in terms of education per se, we want to make sure that we're educating our teachers around issues of race for themselves, their own identities, how this plays out in the classroom, as well as really specifically how we can have these conversations with our children so that we can interrupt what's going on in our cities as opposed to perpetuating it. So unfortunately, it's not just white teachers that we want to impact because of kind of the way that we are raised as white people to think and believe certain things and the biases that we have as a result of growing up in this country and kind of drinking the Kool-Aid of what we're to believe in terms of—
You're talking about implicit bias.
Implicit bias and a lot of deficit thinking that we have, unfortunately, particularly with the African-American community that we've had historically until today. And it's not only white people that have this experience, it's all people, including the African-American community, that has unfortunately internalized this, and that we need to do a lot of work to really speak truth to power and talk about really the assets and create new narratives around the African-American community to really speak what's true. Because race is socially, physically, historically, and legally constructed in our society, and we need to talk about that. We need to talk, kind of really undo our learning and relearn from an asset-based perspective. And our teachers are going to go through this process as part of our certificate in urban education that we're launching this summer. And we're going to really have honest conversations about race. And it starts with ourselves. It starts with looking at our own identities. And it starts with understanding the way we've been socialized around race so that we can kind of unpack that and really talk about the asset-based perspectives of African-American families and all families of color so that we can then internalize that so that when we're talking about exactly what to do or how to talk about things in our classrooms, it won't just be this is what you say, but it'll really come from ourselves internally.
And what are the conversations that parents in particular should have with their children. How should a white parent talk to their child, their white child, about race? And I'll throw that up for anybody. Erica, go ahead.
Just to build on that, I think that, you know, I have two children of my own, a 3- and 5-year-old, and so I ask myself this question every day. I'm very conscious about the way that I talk about people, and not just the way that I talk about people, but the way I treat people walking down the street. Our kids learn more about what we do sometimes than what we say. And I always want to make sure that I'm framing people in really asset-based perspectives, and that I'm encouraging my children, as I do personally, to really have lots of different friends, because that's where you develop a lot of your thoughts and feelings about people, is when you have personal relationships mm-hmm. with people who are different from yourself in every way possible, I think. And so I really encourage that for them. So it's not just what I say and do, but it's what I encourage them to do for themselves, to develop that from through their own experiences as well.
And so these conversations may not be the most comfortable conversations to have, but at the end of the day, Aisha White, and again, you're director of Ready Freddy Pathways to Kindergarten Success, which I left out the Ready Freddy part earlier.
Thank you.
I apologize for that.
That's all right.
Got to get that in there, because that's a way many people will recognize what it is that you're doing. But what about the conversations that parents should have? Are there constructive conversations or more constructive conversations that African-American parents can have with their children that would ameliorate this problem somewhat, to boost their self-esteem?
Mm-hmm. So I don't really have anything descriptive for African-American parents, but my thinking is that as an African-American parent, it would be really helpful if they were able to understand how children begin to recognize and acknowledge race, specifically as race impacts African-American children, because all children go through some developmental stages where they begin to notice things like differences, and then those kind of evolve into what could be biases, and what we want to do is interrupt the biases, and those biases apply not just to white children but to African-American children, because they internalize the biases. So I think the first step would be for parents to gain an understanding and accept the fact that children do recognize race, because very often they don't believe that at 3 years old, they are able to recognize race. And then secondly, I would suggest that parents pay close attention to where their kids are. If there are opportunities for them to respond to questions that their children have about race, the first thing they should do is make sure that they're answering those questions in as a matter-of-fact way as possible, just like they would any other question, because kids will pick up those nonverbal messages from their parents and get the message that this is something that maybe I shouldn't be asking my parent about, and then they'll stop. They actually will stop asking about it. And then thirdly, what I think parents should do is try to see if they can find some resources. The simplest way to start would be to start with some books that acknowledge the skin color, the hair texture of African-American children, and read them to their kids, have conversations afterwards, and use that as a way to kind of build a positive approach to looking at differences, because that's what we really want kids to start out doing.
412-246-2002 to join the conversation with our guests, Aisha White, who is a director of the Ready Freddy Pathways to Kindergarten Success, Shannon Wanless, assistant professor in the Department of Psychology and Education at the University of Pittsburgh, and also Erica Gold Kessenberg, associate director for community partnerships and practice for the Center for Urban Education and associate director for community partnerships and practice for the Center for Urban Education at Pitt. And we have Jamila on the phone from Pittsburgh, ready to join the conversation. Jamila, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Well, thank you. My question was directed to Aisha, but actually, while I was waiting my turn, she addressed the concern that I had, which was if she could give us an example of things that we could do to alleviate this problem. And her response relating to parents really did kind of address that. But I would also like to ask her what specifically does she think the school district can do as relates to our students, all of our students, and helping them to become more knowledgeable and sensitive to issues pertaining to race. So I'll get off and listen to her response. I also would like to say that
Jamila
is
Jamila. Go ahead.
Could I just say this really quickly?
Yeah, sure.
She's a person that many people have known to grow through the Pittsburgh school system, and we are so proud of the work that she has done in teaching and now in position with Ready Freddy. So take care. I'm going to listen for this answer, and thank you.
Thank you so much for the phone call. Aisha, go ahead and
Hi, Jamila. And remember, I need your email because we need to send you a copy of the report because I don't have it. What I'll say is it's kind of bouncing off what Erica had said earlier. I think that anytime any of us want to begin to do work with kids or even with adults, young adults, around race, we really need to gain a better understanding of what race is all about ourselves. So that first step is so important to our development of our understanding of ourselves as racial beings. And then as we relate to our close family members and then beyond that as professionals. I do believe that teachers should internalize the significance of working with children who may be of a different race, because if you're a professional, you should understand the population you are working with, the kids that you're teaching, and that's part of your professional development. But you have to start with yourself first. And we don't want teachers who are kind of like, who don't want to do this kind of thing to be talking to kids about race. We want them to kind of embrace it. We want them to gain their own personal understanding and then in their work with young children be better prepared. But I also think that they too should, once they learn about it, then they're I would assume they'd be more comfortable working with kids and giving off those kinds of messages, those nonverbal messages that I mentioned earlier that parents might give off. They need to help kids understand that this is something that's part of development, part of society, that's not different from anything else. And so if you have questions, I'll do my best to answer. I won't be judgmental. I won't give you the impression that this is something you should not ask about, because that does happen all the time. And so in order for parents, for teachers to be at that point, they really have to become more comfortable accepting the fact that race is important. It's something that they need to learn about before they can begin to work with kids around it.
Pittsburgh is noted for being a very racially segregated city. What effect does this play on African-American children growing up in all black neighborhoods in our city? Erica.
That could be a whole show in itself.
It could. But if you were able to encapsulate your answer, what are your thoughts? And I would invite any of you three to weigh in on that.
I think it's not just the segregation which affects the relationships that people have with each other, but also how our city invests in these communities and the lack of resources that are going to the communities in ways that impact every aspect of life. So I think that that's one of the big issues. And I think that there may be, you know, a lot of people in power, particularly white people, who don't drive into these neighborhoods and therefore don't know the reality, like the real reality of lived experiences in some of our African-American communities, that aren't getting the resources that they need and deserve. And therefore, just like a lot of other things, they can turn a blind eye and, you know, not be aware of it. Again, it begins with awareness. And I think that's one of the cores of the problem.
And based on what you just said, we have the perfect question for you from Uzma in Pittsburgh. Hi, Uzma. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
So my question is that, you know, I'm hearing about this topic, and you know, why is it that perhaps using mindfulness as a tool in schools could be, you know, an answer to some of these problems? Because through mindfulness, we can develop compassion and to realize that the other that we are seeing is just ourselves. And perhaps if the skin color or the hair color is different, it's still a human being. And that's the problem in the world even today, that we fail to see that we are all beings on this earth. And belong to the earth and have less differences between people.
Usman, that's a great point. One question, though, that comes to mind is that, in particular with the studies that have been done, children notice the differences. And so the problem or the challenge there is, you know, how do you instill that kind of thinking, which I think, Usman, is certainly a very good philosophy to have. How do you instill that in children? Is that kind of the challenge there? Shannon?
Well, I appreciate your caller's point about mindfulness. Pitt has a new Center for Mindfulness and Consciousness Studies, and this is certainly something we bring up in teacher education at Pitt and think about ways that you can start to see from others' perspectives and attend to them non-judgmentally. So mindfulness might be one piece of this. But I think one thing that's so hard to accept is that there are differences, and so there are differences historically in the way people treat each other, and systematically looking at racism and how it affects people's lives plays out in ways that maybe we wish weren't there, but it is. And so addressing this with children when they see differences and as Aisha mentioned, instead of being afraid of those conversations, but figuring out how to have them and build on children's natural tendency towards fairness and equity so that we can see them and bring them to the forefront and say, this is something that is out there. The ways people are treated are often different. How can we talk about them, see them, and then make that the first step in addressing it?
It kind of goes back to that idea that you can't be colorblind, or you can't advocate for people being colorblind. Erica, you're nodding.
I agree.
Fair enough. Let's go to Daria, who's calling from the Pennsylvania Turnpike. Hi, Daria. Hopefully you've pulled over to join our conversation. Welcome.
Yes, and I appreciate you taking my call. I was calling because I was very pleased to hear the conversation taking place. And the authenticity of the conversation, because I find sometimes people will discuss the matter, but they don't want to get really to the root of the problem. And Shannon, Eric.
Oh. Daria, if you can hear us, we've lost you.
I wondered.
Oh, there you are. Okay. Go ahead with question. No, we lost you for a bit there, but you're back. So go ahead with your question.
I appreciate you guys taking my call, but I wanted to ask some questions about what is being done. I am a product of the Wilkinsburg Public School System, Wilkinsburg District, and I found myself in a very similar predicament as students who are currently being educated in neighboring communities in Pittsburgh. For me, I was able to come across some positive professionals that looked like me that gave more positive influence than I was receiving because I was one of those students who didn't have teachers who looked like me. I since have become a teacher, and I have been teaching for 22 years. And I find it very important that people are open to receive information to help them better educate people who do not look like them. So one of my questions was about what is being done regarding teaching students of different cultures besides the African-American culture, because I'm just leaving Pittsburgh today. I've observed a lot of multiculturalism, and I just wanted to know if there's any discussion about the culturally responsive pedagogy that goes along with it, and not just deem it necessary for African-American students, but all students who are different from the majority.
Great question. And Erica is going to answer that before we go to break.
Absolutely. Yes, we're in complete agreement with you of how critically important that is. And the Center for Urban Education is supporting all of our teacher education programs in our school to move that forward. And particularly the Certificate in Urban Education that we're launching this summer has an entire course on culturally relevant teaching, along with the courses around identity and developing deep relationships with students, families, and communities, being a change agent in the schools, and talking about race holistically and diversity overall is one of the key focus and foundations for the work.
And I want to get into some of the details of the study. We certainly talked about the problem, possible solutions, and it's a great conversation. We will continue looking at the study, the collaborative study between the University of Pittsburgh and Pittsburgh Public Schools on the link between racial identity and student achievement. We do need to take a break. This is Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're discussing a collaborative study between the University of Pittsburgh and Pittsburgh Public Schools on the link between racial identity and student achievement. And it has been hypothesized that negative racial identities among young children are contributing to the performance gap among minorities. So we've been speaking with some individuals who've been involved in a study to find out why. And after months of research, we have had representatives here with us from Pitt School of Education and Ready Freddy Pathways to Kindergarten Success, as well as the Center for Urban Education, to talk about this issue. And we had Erica Gold Kestenberg joining us, Associate Director for Community Partnerships and Practice for the Center for Urban Education at the University of Pittsburgh. She is has made way now for Medina Jackson to join our other guests. Medina Jackson is Pathways to Kindergarten Success Outreach Coordinator. Yes. Hi, Medina. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And also with us, if you're just tuning in, Shannon Wanless, Assistant Professor to the Department of Psychology in Education at the University of Pittsburgh. Assistant Professor in the Department of Psychology and Education at the University of Pittsburgh. I'll get it right, Shannon. And also with us, Aisha White, Director of Ready Freddy Pathways to Kindergarten Success. And Aisha is going to talk about the study, which we want to get into the particulars of how this research was done. But before we do that, let's take a call at 412-246-2002 from Linda in Swissvale. Hi, Linda. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi there. I just had a quick question. I'm wondering what is being done at the higher education level in terms of training teachers. You know, we're training a lot of teachers in Western Pennsylvania, and I would say the majority of the folks are Caucasian. And I just think there's a really low awareness of cultural differences among young teachers. So I just wondered about that, if there's any effort to remedy that.
Okay, again, just to clarify, Linda, you're saying there's a low awareness among young teachers?
Yes, of the cultural differences.
Okay, interesting question. I would think that people would assume that experienced teachers teachers who have that younger teachers would be more sensitive to this, but apparently that's not the case.
Well, it's certainly the case that this is something we've ramped up our efforts in the School of Education at Pitt to address. Even in the most recent years, now we have a Center of Urban Education up and running, as Erica mentioned, and so their support has really allowed us as faculty to learn more about this issue. And then the collaborative that's here talking about our Pride Report today has really supported each other learning about race in schools and in child development, because it's not something that has been directly addressed enough in the research, particularly for young children. And so through no fault of teachers, it hasn't been something they've been learning because there haven't been evidence-based practices to teach them.
Were you surprised to learn that?
Somewhat, yes, I have to say. But I at the same time, it really isn't something that I feel like we've had permission or comfort in society to address and talk about. It's not easy to start having conversations about race when it might be something that's seen as taboo or addressing discrimination when it's not there. So Rich Milner at the Center of Urban Education has a book, Start Where You Are, But Don't Stay Here and Stay There. And that's exactly the philosophy that we've been taking of how can we see where we are, what we know at this point, and take the opportunity to move forward with that.
And we'll get to another call here momentarily. So Robert and Homewood, stay with us. But I did want to get to the meat and potatoes of this study. Aisha White, how was it done? Let's get some background on the research. And also, where did it start?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a long story. I'm going to try to be as brief as possible, but I could really go on. It actually began, the seed of it began over a year ago, about a year and 2 months ago, when Carol Barone Martin, who's the director of early childhood education for Pittsburgh Public Schools, sent an article to one of our colleagues in the Office of Child Development. And she read the article and shared it with our Ready Freddy team. The article just happened to be by Rich Milner. The title of it was A Black Father's Search for a Diverse Preschool, and he was looking for preschools for his twin daughters. We read the article. It was suggested that maybe our team, meaning our small Ready Freddy team, which consists of about five or six people, might be able to contribute to a solution to some of the problems that he raised in the article. And in response, I suggested that, well, before we can do that as a team, we really need to learn about race, because we were not talking about race in our office. And so I volunteered to find research articles, which we began to read over the course of about 5 or 6 months. We would read the articles between meetings, have conversations about the articles. And then one conversation led to another. We decided that we would actually invite Rich, Dr. Milner, over to the Office of Child Development for a large presentation that was community-wide. We invited our partners and friends from the community, as well as our office mates in the Office of Child Development. That led us to think that we should include the Q team and any kind of moving forward or steps that we would take next. It just kind of organically evolved that Medina met Shannon at an event in the Hill, where they were talking about early education. Medina asked a question about race, and Shannon ran over to talk to Medina afterwards. And then we kind of all came together and began to have more deep conversations about it. Then what happened next was we decided that we would apply for an internal fund from the Office of Child Development. It's called the Kaplan Fund. Kaplan Fund. We got money to put together a what we call an environmental scan. And the scan consisted of a number of research points. One was Shannon's observations, which she'll talk about later. Another was focus groups with parents and with teachers. Another was a review of the literature. We looked at a whole lot of literature around race and education in general, not just early education, because the research on early education and race is pretty limited. We also did a review of the curriculum that's out there. We made phone calls, interviews to what we're calling key informants, and we also pulled together a local advisory committee. So once we got all that information together, we worked for at least 4.5 to 5 months to write up the results, which turned out to be the prior report.
And so let's work Medina Jackson into the conversation. Again, she's the Pathways to Kindergarten Success Outreach Coordinator. What, you know, based on the research here, what are some of the things that you think are important for dealing with this larger issue?
Mm-hmm. Well, first, I'd like to talk about kind of what we heard from parents and educators, which leads into what's important. So some of the things that we heard from parents were, first, we have to remember that parents were once children. And so there, many of them are still grappling with their own experiences around race that happened in their formative years, which influenced their self-perception and how they parent. They also wish that they had more experiences growing up where they had the opportunity to learn about race and ethnicity and history and culture, so that they'd better be able to transfer that information to their children. They wish they learned it at home and in schools and in their communities. They're also really concerned about issues regarding race and their children. They really conveyed a sense of urgency in doing something about it now. Some of those issues were finding a diverse preschool, to concerns about their children losing their racial and cultural identity and difference when placed in different settings. They even talked about their children being unfairly targeted by police when they get older and not having enough positive images and messages in the media. So, you know, they all love Doc McStuffins, but they need more than Doc McStuffins. So we need more images for our children. And they also would really welcome resources in-home and in the schools and in the community that would really develop their children's pride skills. They really want a village of support. They want books and activities for their children to really develop their pride skills. They want access to their own family history and genealogy. These are some actionable possible things that can happen, that in ways that are affordable. They want to get with other parents to support each other and share resources and have help in responding to specific incidents of discrimination. And as for teachers, we really found that teachers felt that early childhood is an appropriate space to talk about race, but they had many different ways in which they spoke about it or responded to children's questions. They also felt that they could have used more information, more training in their pre-service time in higher education, as well as ongoing training and support. And they want tangible resources that they can use in the classroom, more support from their administrators, more connection with parents so that there's home-to-school continuity, and more ways to strengthen and create events and activities around developing pride in students and curriculum, lesson plans, books, really tangible things.
Well, you're bringing to mind a million questions here. I want to talk about how do you address this with children in early, who are early childhood education would be, younger than five. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, how do you address that with children that young?
Mm-hmm. Well, I can speak for myself and my experience as a parent. I'm the parent of a young child. So we really started with books. One great book that we really loved was Shades of Black, A Celebration of Our Children by Sandra Pinckney. There are other websites like the Brown Bookshelf and blackchildbooks.com. So books are really an opportunity to just open that door. And I think it's really important. You know, I try to be cognizant and aware of my experiences with race as a child, which shaped me as an adult and how I parent. And really, it's about trying our best to address whatever our child is bringing up in the moment. We may not have time to really go into a detailed conversation when we're running around crazy
and
in
kids,
the grocery store. But
kids don't necessarily clue in on when is a good time to talk to mommy
right,
about
exactly.
this. It's like, boom, here's my question. And you might be walking
might
down
be
the aisle
in
the grocery
things.
Store.
So you just,
and,
yeah, you just have to make a mental bookmark and then say, okay, we're going to talk about this later and make it a point not to shush it and know that it's important and really listen to their questions, listen to their perspective and experience their feelings about it and probe in a way that's non-judgmental.
All right, a quick comment before we go to break. Robert in Homewood, you have a very important question or comment, so I will make sure we get to you right out of the break. Shannon, before we go to break, there was a point you wanted to make.
I just want to underscore Medina's points about books and things, but also take a little pressure off parents as one myself that you may not always have the right answer or the right book on you. And I hear parents say, I missed the moment. My child asked a question and I didn't really jump on it the way I'd like to. But to really say it's okay to come back a day later, an hour later, a few days later, bring your relevant book then and start the conversation again.
All right, we'll take the break that we have been intending to, and when we come back, we'll take your calls at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH@WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking about a collaborative study between the University of Pittsburgh and Pittsburgh Public Schools on the link between racial identity and student achievement. And speaking of student achievement, as a student, I never seemed to have a pen that was working, and Aisha just handed me one that is working, so I thank you for that. There was a hypothesis that negative racial identities among young children was contributing to the performance gap among minorities. And so the individuals who have joined me sought to find out why that is. And after 9 months of research, or after months of research, representatives are here to tell us about the study from Pitt's School of Education. And if you're just joining us, we have in studio with us Aisha White. She's the director of Ready Freddy Pathways to Kindergarten Success. Shannon Wanless, assistant professor in the Department of Psychology and Education at the University of Pittsburgh. And also with us, joining us for this segment is Medina Jackson, Pathways to Kindergarten Success Outreach Coordinator. Actually, she was with us in our last segment, but joined us midway through the show. You need a program to follow everything that's going on, but I think we've got it all figured out here. So we promised Robert in Homewood, who's been holding at 412-246-2002, that we would get to his question right out of the break. And so, Robert, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. Just as quickly as I can, the study may contribute a little bit to sort of a Hegelian dialectic on race. We've got maybe a fundamentally flawed application of segregation to African-American communities. The most obvious question in my mind is when you walk in, most of you have probably been to a Chinatown in a major metropolitan area, and you can remember the mental images and emotional reactions to it. Most people, you may agree, don't get an overwhelming sense that they need to integrate Chinatown. And most certainly we don't refer to a Chinatown as a segregated community. That's just not what comes to mind. I'm afraid that where we go with issues of racial identity play very much to what one of the speakers mentioned earlier, is that it's more resource segregated than it is racial segregation. And we've kind of lost the meaning of assimilation versus integration versus segregation versus aggregation. Blacks have as much of a need for aggregation culturally as any other community. And as long as we view that as segregation, we're going to end up creating more problems with the studies and the conclusions than we solve. So if you think about the Asian Chinatown models, that may be a better way of looking at things, or at least a more constructive way of looking at what turns out to be African-American communities. Do you think that the study is going to contribute to the dialectic on this as opposed to maybe creating conclusions that exacerbate the problem?
Interesting question. Who would like to take that? Aisha?
I will take a stab at it.
All right.
It may be beyond my pay range, pay scale, if that's the right word. But I think I do get a sense of the gist of the question or the statement. And the thing to keep in mind is when I think about Chinatown, it is typically a positive thought process. However, the Chinatowns that I've been to are not where people live. It's where they have their businesses. And so it's like a really rich environment where people can go and they can go to Chinese restaurants and there may be Chinese cultural events and that sort of thing, which is a little different from where Chinese people live. But I think that what we're trying to say is we want, and specifically African-American children, we want African-American children to feel good about their race, about their family, about their larger family, which is the Africana race. And we want them to feel good about African culture, African music, anything that has to do with African people. And so in that sense, we are trying to create a sort of really supportive and rich community for kids in terms of the materials that we provide for them and the education that we provide for them. And the hope would be that if we're successful with that and kids are successful in school, then some of those positive environments that he's referring to will exist, that we will be able to get beyond some of the issues that we see resulting from kids not having a positive education, such as them being involved in the criminal justice system. And so we are looking at culture as part of this whole process. And so it's not really dichotic the way we're looking at it.
One of the things that, and Robert, thank you for that call. One of the things that occurs to me is that having grown up in this city, it is a city, so much of the history here has been shaped by African Americans, for example. And it would seem impossible for even a white kid, as was the case with myself growing up, to not notice that there are so many heroic examples of people in our community contributing to the positive aspects of our city and the positive image that we have of our city. And I use as an example, there was a kid that I didn't particularly get along with that well when I was in eighth grade. until we both realized that Roberto Clemente was our favorite player, and we found common ground there. And as I learned about Roberto Clemente, I thought, wow, he speaks with a heavy accent. Where's he from? He's from Puerto Rico. Well, what other players came from Puerto Rico? Turns out many players from Puerto Rico populated the Negro Leagues. What? There were separate leagues for blacks and whites? Turns out Pittsburgh had has a storied history with the Negro Leagues, with the Pittsburgh Crawfords and the Homestead Grays. So isn't it a matter of maybe just taking a breath and looking around at what is all around us? Are we kind of missing the obvious here, even with kids? Shannon?
I think what we notice with young children is it's just not going to happen on accident. So these positive role models may be around us, and that's wonderful, but we have to intentionally bring them up, talk about them. And it's not just buying the books and putting them on the shelf or putting up the posters. It's getting comfortable talking about these role models ourselves and other positive experiences so that we can say, how are we going to bring this into the classroom or our life at home or our weekend activities as a family or our local celebrations so that we don't just hope this will happen because it's in our history. We make an intentional plan to bring it up and make sure it fosters this positive racial identity that can have such positive long-term outcomes.
Medina?
Yes, I would agree. I think it just requires a real intentional approach on behalf of families, on behalf of teachers and educators and community-based organizations, because children are receiving messages implicitly and explicitly all of the time. So just like they're receiving those messages, we need to be really intentional about countering those messages and talking about that history and culture and lineage so that our children feel proud about it.
If best practices, as they are called, and techniques to instill positive racial identities can never wholly compensate for the effects of racial bias in our culture, then what are the recommendations for dealing with this larger issue? Shannon's going to jump in on that one.
Well, that's a big question, I will say. But one thing that makes
That's what I'm here to do, ask the big questions.
One thing that makes me very excited about our work, I see a lot of our conversation about pride being at the individual level. How do we help children? How do we help families develop pride? But really, when you think about discrimination and institutional racism as a systemic or a social problem, society and institutions are just makeups of lots of individuals. They're collections of individuals. And so when we start to instill pride in individual children and adults and we raise awareness, then you get a large collection of them. That's when some of these larger social shifts can occur.
And so what are some of the ideas that we've got a couple of minutes left? So I'd like Aisha and Medina to each get an opportunity to talk about what have we learned and what should we do going forward? And again, you each have about maybe 45 seconds to try to answer that. Mm-hmm. Not easy, but that's the challenge of radio.
Okay. So what we've produced in the form of the report and what people will find at the end of the report are our conclusions and recommendations. And those recommendations are laid out pretty clearly, focusing on specific target populations. So we have some really specific and unique suggestions for what teachers can do, and those have a lot to do with more training for teachers. As I referred to earlier, they have to do that internal work first. But what we also would like to do is, as our team, try to get some funding so we can come up with some packaged resources that teachers could have access to. Because what Medina had mentioned earlier was that teachers say, okay, this is important, I agree, but what do I do? So they need something kind of tangible to start with. The exact same thing for parents. So we have some specific things, some ideas for how we can reach out to parents, create those opportunities for parents to talk to each other about this issue and learn from each other, and give them, again, resources that they can use with their children. It's a little more complicated in terms of recommendations for policymakers and researchers and community people, but, you know, at a start, We really are making a call for researchers to begin to study young children and race, because a lot of that research is focused on older kids. And for policymakers, we have some specific ideas, and all of it has to do with making race important to in whatever sphere you're in. So if you're a funder, make race important. If you're in politics, make race important.
Okay, Medina, less than 30 seconds, unfortunately.
Sure, no problem. Well, I think Aisha really said it all, but I'll just add and emphasize the importance of us knowing that each individual person, all of us has a role, all of us are accountable in looking at race, and we have to first start with being self-reflective about our own experiences as racial beings and looking at the information that we got, where we got that information from, and if it came from a place of love and support or miseducation. It starts with the individual.
That's Medina Jackson, Pathways to Kindergarten Success Outreach Coordinator. Also, thanks to Erica Gold Kesterberg, Associate Director for Community Partnerships and Practice for the Center for Urban Education at Pitt. Shannon Wanless, Assistant Professor in the Department of Psychology and Education at the University of Pittsburgh, and Aisha White, Director of Pathways to Kindergarten Success. We'll have our David Harris interview for you tomorrow. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long.